Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Anne Stickney, one of two lore-focused writers from Blizzard Watch, and I have both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today. They're both back. Hey, Rossi, how's it going? We missed you last time.
Why are we even bothering? Nothing happened this week. Can't we just go home?
No.
I don't see anything. There's nothing to talk about.
No. We actually have so many questions this week, you wouldn't believe it.
I believe it.
This is Rossi trying to punish me for my comments in collaboration with Adam about Diablo. That's all.
Okay, whatever. Anyway, speaking of which, because he's already piped up, we've got our other co-host with us today, and that would be Joe Perez. Hey, Joe.
Well, hey there.
You're coming in from remote, which is why your microphone sounds a little bit different, in case people were wondering.
Yes, yeah, so I do apologize, folks, but...
No, you
had to put him
fine.
On Kulturas. He's in Kulturas.
I'm totally in Kulturas reporting live.
How many sea monsters have you run into so far today?
It's a light day, only 4.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
They all look like Lurker from Below, though, so I don't know.
So, speaking of Kulturas and everything else, hey, guys, guess what? BlizzCon 2017 just happened. That was big. There was... A lot of stuff went down. A lot of stuff was announced. I am dying to dive into anything and everything related to Moira and finding out more about her in Overwatch. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. Because we're going to talk about the new expansion that was announced. Battle for Azeroth. And Battle for Azeroth, thus far, doesn't appear to be focused on any of the things that we may have speculated about in the past. It has been mentioned that Azshara will show up at some point. There was some beautiful concept of art of her, which I was very excited about. But mostly what we're looking at here is it's going to be the factions in full-out war with all kinds of chaos going down and the opening sequence to it that everybody's going to play through, much like the Assault on the Broken Shore, is Well, it's like Battle for the Undercity Round 2, except that it's not a coup from within. It's just the Alliance is attacking the Undercity and would like to destroy it. And the Horde is trying to defend the Undercity because they would like it not destroyed. Also, Teldrassil is on fire? What? Okay. So yeah, Battle for Azeroth happened. It was announced, and these two factions are now at full-on war with each other, which is... Well, it's not anywhere where we thought it was going to go. However, some of the places that we predicted are actually going to show up. Kulturas is going to be a thing, finally. I'm very excited about this. It is not a island that has been transformed into a giant ship. It's just an island. Zandalar, we're also going to get to travel to, which is great. And it's kind of like the center of troll culture and looks really amazing. So there's these two new zones, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff coming in the form of war fronts and also island exploration, the return of something that looks very much like three-person scenarios, and I am so jazzed about that.
Three-person role agnostic scenarios.
Yep, exactly. It's just like scenarios from Mists of Pandaria. This is why I'm really excited. So we have all of that. We have a lot of story. Jaina is back. She is in Kul Tiras. Her mom is there. Who saw that coming? I did not. I didn't even know her mom was alive or what her name was or anything about her. So we have a lot of new lore that was introduced. And we've gotten a lot of questions from people regarding the reveals and everything that's been going on in BlizzCon. It is a substantial list. So what I would like to do is go through this list of questions and answer those. And while we're answering them, we'll also talk about lore, because that's what we do. Sound good to you guys?
Yes, let's do this thing.
It's what we do.
All right, buckle up. This is going to get rocky, probably. Okay, first question is from Straylight, who says, in the Steve Burke interview, and this was game designer Steve Burke, we interviewed him yesterday, the interview is up on the website. In the interview, he says, we are retiring the artifact weapons in a very epic way that we think everyone will be very happy with. Now that we have some more context on what the next expansion is going to be, do you have any more predictions or solid guesses as to what that send-off might be? And again, that was from Starlight. So we do know that artifacts are not moving forward with us. What do you guys think's going to happen to them?
Some of this is based on spoiler information, so I'm not going to go into too many specifics so I don't actually spoil you, but pay attention to the last encounter in Antorus.
Okay.
That's what I'll say.
Okay. Joe, do you have any kind of predictions, wild predictions or anything?
I mean, we've been pumping power into these things for so long that, I mean, we're going to have to probably expend them in a very power-intensive manner. So I think what Rossi says is pretty sufficient. Like, I think we all know, at least have a good idea where we're going to wind up burning them up.
I don't know about you, but I'm at, like, artifact level 69. Nice. And I think the next level, I have to pump something like 50 or 60 billion artifact power into my weapon to get it even further. So we've been putting colossal amounts of power in these things. They are ridiculously powerful, far more powerful than probably any one weapon should rightfully be. The only thing, you know, I don't mind that we're giving them a send-off, right? I don't mind that we're using them for whatever intended purpose, whatever that happens to be. I don't mind that, you know, there's going to be some kind of glorious finish with our artifact weapons. What I do mind, in kind of a sad, wistful kind of way, is that it means that artifact weapons like, oh, I don't know, the Ashbringer are going to be gone for good, in theory. Or do you think we're going to stick them in a museum? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well,
are
I know
they
going we're
to be destroyed?
I think that might be part of it, right? Like, I think that maybe not destroyed, but we may burn the power out of them that we've put into it. And one thing I do know from all the previous expansions is that anything that was of significant note, we tend to keep in one fashion or another, whether it's a burnt out husk or something that we sort of put on a mantle as a, hey, remember this thing we did? It was really epic. We should kind of keep this up and
some
sort
kind
of like,
display or statue, yeah, or commemorative something.
And now the thing is, too, and I could see this sort of playing into the next expansion a little bit, where everything is very faction focused. Well, if your faction has a new center where they're like, you know, remembering all the great deeds that they did, or they need that sort of morale boost, I could totally see maybe all of the artifacts on display there as like a Hall of Heroes type thing.
What do you think, Rossi?
I don't know, because they've talked about how you're going to still be able to use them for transmog.
For me, it's like. You have this weapon, like, you have this weapon, you've spent all this time pumping all this power into this weapon, you've carried it throughout the expansion, you've hopefully vanquished the Burning Legion with it, or at least, you know, got rid of them for the time being, quote unquote. And then at the end of all of that, it's like, what do you get from it? Do you get, like, I don't know, do you get, I wielded the Ashbringer and all I got was this lousy t-shirt? Or, like, do we get a souvenir? Is there...
See, I've been thinking about, one of the things I've been thinking about in terms of the artifacts for a while now is some of the artifacts. I mean, I love my warrior artifacts. I really do. I think they're really cool. But before this expansion, I'd never heard of one of them. But the Ashbringer.
But now you love them, though, right?
Yeah, but the Ashbringer is the Ashbringer.
And then the Scythe of a Loon is the Scythe of a Loon. Like, there's a few weapons in there where it's like, oh, like, Fela Malorn, there's a few weapons in there that are just like, wow, we're getting like, rid of that.
The Ashbringer, Fela Malorn, the Scythe of a Loon, the Doomhammer, I mean...
Yeah.
Even the Scepter of Azjara, like, it has significance. Like, that's one of the problems that we come up against with this particular thing, is that all of the artifacts that we have significance in the story to either the current world, previous story, or NPCs that we're going to be interacting with again.
Yeah, but it's as much as like a lot of them, like the Fist of Ra'den is extremely cool.
Yeah.
It's
got a great story, the lore of, you know, he used this to help make the elemental planes. Or there's the staff, the Alumeth, the mage staff, the one that talks to you. And it's basically really snarky and you know, full of itself. That's all, you know, like the Shadow Priest dagger, that's pure evil. And it's
Zolotath,
like,
yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, my warrior's sword, the one, I can't remember the name off the top of my head right now because I'm tired too. The two-hander from Stromgard. Stromkar.
I thought we were just going to say Ashkandi again.
Oh, no, Stromkar. No, Ashkandi's not actually.
Stromkar. Stromkar has also got a lot of history in it, though.
Stromkar, not only does it have a lot of history, it is the foundation sword of the first human kingdom. And it makes trolls run away in terror when I brandish it. So I get why they don't want me to use it. I was talking to my wife about that. She's like, does it make the trolls in Zandalar run away? I'm like, it probably just makes them angry. You end up having to get rid of it because just every troll tries to murder you constantly until you do. But
I don't think the Zandalar ever had to deal with Strom. And I think if a Zandalar...
They run away from me all the time when I take it to the Throne of Thunder, and that's Zandalar.
Yeah, but that's a different... I guess. Okay.
Hey, the Loa talk, man. I'm just saying. Like, they talk.
At any rate, all these weapons, I honestly don't think they're going to be destroyed, because can you imagine the player outcry if they destroyed Ashbringer?
Burning the energy
just makes
is one
me,
thing.
Like
is a
the
whole
thought,
other.
The thought of doing that just makes me a little sad, because I'm like, these are weapons that, I mean, they're entrenched in Warcraft lore. I mean, they really are. They're entrenched in Warcraft lore, and there's part
of
it in a significant way.
How much time recovering?
But then, beyond that, it's this really, you know, powerhouse part of Warcraft lore is just like nostalgia, maybe sheer nostalgia factor. Because I remember in vanilla, everybody trying to find Ashbringer. There was like this long hunt where people were convinced that if they looked long enough and hard enough, they could find Ashbringer. And there was this whole community thing built around it where people were trying to uncover the secret of the Ashbringer. And then when the corrupted one finally showed up in Naxxramas, everybody just lost it. They thought it was fantastic.
I gotta tell a story about that.
Oh, go ahead.
Fast. When the corrupted Ashbringer dropped, we had various people in our guild talking about getting it, like, you know, paladins and warriors and so forth, talking about, oh, who's going to get the corrupted Ashbringer. When it dropped, our hunter lead, who had more DKP than anyone because there was nothing for him to spend it on. He was always, like, waiting till everybody else got their stuff to spend his DKP.
Oh, no.
He spent literally, I think, like 2,000 DKP to get it.
He
spent all of it to get the corrupted Ashbringer, and everyone's jaws were on the floor as this hunter just bought the most powerful melee weapon, you know, outside of the one that dropped off of Kel'Thuzan.
Hey,
and we were
in
nowhere.
Vanilla, everything was a hunter weapon.
Yeah, this actually was, you know, to a certain degree. I mean, he knew full well what he was doing. He was like, "Nope, sorry, I got to have this." I'll give him credit for he then went to Scarlet Monastery with it and did the whole thing. And that was really great. But yeah, that weapon, he knew full well what he was doing, but it was the Ashbringer. You know what I mean? This was a guy who was never that guy. He was never the hunter who took stuff, you know, that other people could make better use of, but it was the Ashbringer. So he went for it. Getting rid of the Ashbringer feels strange to me. Like the idea of a paladin, okay, I was using the Ashbringer for a while, but now I'm going to use this green sword of the boar that dropped because it's got higher deep. It's just weird, man.
Something of the whale.
Yeah, you know, the
Spirit,
I don't even know.
Stam. Need both those things.
Kul'Tiran mace of the you know, whale or something. Yeah,
but the idea of expending the power of a super, you know, important artifact or piece of lore in order to accomplish a goal is nothing foreign to us. Like, look at the Dragon Soul, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just that.
So
I don't think that we had as much of a personal connection with the Dragon Soul, whereas these weapons, we've been carting them around this whole expansion.
Oh, sure, sure. But I mean, like, that, and that's why I'm saying, like, I can totally see us, you know, using the power that we've put into them sort of like a artifact power savings account, right?
It's going to be hilarious when I get to give, when you have to give Illyria back her bow. Illyria, sorry, it's still here.
It's in one piece.
I had to burn out all the stuff I put in it, but you know, hey, you didn't need it bedazzled anyway. So here's your bow.
You got a new one, right? Like you don't need this anymore, but you know, it's okay.
I'm still maintaining they belong in a museum. They belong in a museum. I think they should go in a museum somewhere, all of them.
See,
I'm hoping we don't just wipe them out entirely. Okay.
And I'd be okay with that. I'd be okay with a Hall of Heroes scenario for the weapons. They've earned it.
Okay. So next we have a series of questions from, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly, Eleftherios, who first question says, is there any hint in what the timeline of faction attacks will be already? Now, here's what we're talking about in terms of faction attacks. Remember when I said that Teldrassil is literally on fire? Okay, so Teldrassil is literally on fire. There was a slide that showed it. It was really disturbing. And we do know that there is going to be a battle going down for Lordaeron. And that's going to be the opening sequence. What we don't know is we don't know which one of these happened first. Like, is Lordaeron retaliation for Teldrassil? Is Teldrassil retaliation for Lordaeron? Which one is it? So do you guys... I don't think that there was any hints, really. I think they were deliberately vague.
Afrasiabi actually even said they weren't going to tell us.
Yeah, the only hint...
He straight up said, did this happen? Did Darnassus burn because of the Lordaeron attack? Or did they attack Lordaeron because of Darnassus? We're not saying yet.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The only thing we have any hints of is the spoiled epilogue for Christy Golden's new book.
The prologue.
That's the only hint I think we have right now. They've been very, very tight-lipped about everything else.
And for people wondering what that is, Christy Golden's next novel, Before the Storm, in the BlizzCon 2017 goodie bags, there was an excerpt from the book. It was just the prologue for the book. And it has Nathanos and Sylvanas talking to each other. They're talking about a new faction, like council type thing, that has risen up in the Undercity in Sylvanas's absence. And they aren't too keen on that whole immortality thing that she's chasing, apparently, which is interesting in and of itself. But at the end of it all, Sylvanas says, we need our armies, and you know what we need them for, Stormwind. So the clear intention there is that Sylvanas wants to attack Stormwind for some reason. Don't know why, assuming that'll come up in the novel. The novel's due out in May. I'm very excited about this because I need to know what happens here. What the heck? I guess if you put those three pieces together, it feels like maybe she tried to attack Stormwind. They went after Undercity in, like, response to that. Since they took her capital away, she decided to torch Teldrassil. But it could be the other way around, too. It could be, I don't know.
Well, there's another piece of information, too, and this is, I mean, slight spoiler-ish. And I don't know, again, because this is all, you know, BlizzCon stuff.
Wait, spoiler-ish for what?
Like, it's not a hard line, but they were talking about...
Were they talking about this in a panel?
I believe they were about the continents.
Okay, if they talked about it at BlizzCon, we can talk about it. If it's anything having to do with, like, raid content that hasn't come out yet, let's avoid that. But
no, this is they were talking at BlizzCon specifically about the continents becoming very faction specific. And so everything we're seeing feed into this is very, you know, the wars is very clearly like the burning of Darnassus. Well, that would make sense to try to make the Night Elves go to the Eastern Kingdoms, right? Whereas you have the Undercity in the Eastern Kingdoms, and sacking that forces them over to Kalimdor, which where in the prologue excerpt, Sylvanas has been spending way more time in Orgrimmar, if anywhere, than she has Undercity anyway, so it sort of feeds into that as well. So I find it really interesting that they're showing us slides that sort of reinforce this, where...
There is a specific slide where they show, they literally start on a picture of Kalimdor, and they have Darnassus flame up, and then they have the whole continent red. which means that the Night Elves didn't just get knocked out of Teldrassil. They also lost Feralas and Ashenvale and everything.
Right.
And then the as the map goes over, the Eastern Kingdoms, let's just say it. The Horde loses at Lordaeron. Lordaeron is gone.
It has to be in order for
this to work. No, it's not just it has to be. They said at panels, it's gone.
It's
gone. This is out of their mouths. They lose.
Teldrassil is gone.
The things that they didn't...
is gone. The Horde is gone. The Lordaeron's gone. And the reason that... They even said this in a thing about Stromgarde. The reason that the Alliance doesn't try and just live in Lordaeron is because the Draenei and the Blood Elves are still in their places.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. That's the only thing that they haven't haven't resolved yet.
They
right?
straight up addressed that. They even said, "No, they're still there." The reason that the Alliance doesn't just take over Lordaeron is it isn't defensible with Quel'Thalas right there.
Okay, but let Joe finish what he was saying.
Yeah,
I was just going to say that's the only outlier for each is the Blood Elves in Silvermoon, and then you have the Exodar and the Draenei, where they're sort of their only holdouts. They're the only places, which is interesting to me that they wouldn't. And I'm wondering if that's going to play into the story later on, where maybe there's an assault on those, right?
You know, there's been conflicting reports on that, because I actually, when Dan was going to go do this interview, I told him to ask that very specifically, whether or not we would see anything in Silvermoon or the Exodar to reflect what was going on just beyond the borders.
Well, I'm kind of curious about that as well, because story-wise, there are certain things that could make sense. Like, with Silvermoon, if Illyria comes back and brings back a whole bunch of, Void Elves with her and says, "We're taking this back, this is ours, get the heck out," I could totally see that. And with Lightforged, I could totally see them saying, "Well, we have this awesome ship, we can just relocate anywhere. All right, well, the Exodar has, been tainted, it's been invaded, it's been whatever. Let's just kind of leave it be and kind of
let's
move
relocate
away.
And regroup."
Yeah, because now they can, right? Like, I could totally see that sort of working out. I'm just curious how long it's going to take.
I just
and
don't
if there's
see,
going to be in-game events for it.
I don't see in any circumstance, I don't see the Blood Elves abandoning the Sunwell. I don't think it's going to happen.
Abandon would be strong. I don't think abandon would be necessarily
honestly think,
right.
I think one of the things to keep in mind, though, is that what we don't know yet is we haven't talked about the allied races.
No, that's going to be the next question. We'll get into that.
We do kind of need to talk about it now, because what we're talking about needs to move to that then.
So
okay,
I think
well,
it's maybe time we move on to the next question.
Yeah,
then, right?
Let's move on. Okay, second question. Do the capital cities fall before or after the new races join the Alliance or the Horde? Does it make a difference for you? The questions to make them join is max level content. I guess the question is, do you have to be max level to make them join you? The answer to that is yes.
We know that, yeah.
And I'm assuming that the capital cities fall before, because obviously this whole Lordaeron thing is the introductory thing for the expansion.
Yeah, it's the starting, but so yeah, they fall before.
Okay. And it would make sense too, though, that the capital cities would have to fall, because it would be a great point of leverage when approaching those races too. Like let's say the Blood Elves get displaced for whatever reason, from where they are, I feel the Nightborn would really sort of sympathize with that as well. Just like it would be sort of the same thing as when the Blood Elves were sympathizing with, or empathizing really with the Nightborn about their addiction. Like it sort of strengthens that bond if that happens. Right. Or, the same thing with the Lightforged. If the Draenei get pushed out of where they are for whatever reason, and the Alliance takes them in and shelters them in, then it's one of those things where it's very easy to go to the Army of Light and say, "Look, these are the people that you're basically born from. You may be reconstituted or reshaped, but this is still your people. We're taking them in. Look what happened to the remnants of your people. Why don't you come help us with that?" I can totally see that playing out.
Now, keep in mind, too, with the allied races, from what we've gathered, what was given to us at BlizzCon, each of the allied races, there will be a series of quests and challenges that you undertake that kind of tell the story of how you're convincing these people to join, apparently. And at the end of that, they will join you. It also unlocks the ability for you to play one of these allied races, like you can roll one of these allied races. You start at level 20 with them. But you don't get them at max level. You have to actually level them up. And let's see here. We had on the Horde, we've got the Nightborn, the Xandalar, the High Mountain, correct?
Yep.
Yes.
Which I really hope I can race change into a High Mountain once I've unlocked them, because Loader needs antlers.
They haven't specified that one way or another.
You know, they did. Afrasiabi did.
Okay.
Yeah, Afrasiabi and Hazacosta said, yeah, they will allow race change once you've unlocked them, because they don't want people to feel penalized.
Okay.
No, they are going to do that.
But you do have to unlock them first.
You have to go through the quest chain first. Yes.
On the Alliance side, we have the Lightforged Draenei, which we knew about. We have the Void Elves, which we knew about. And then we also, what's the third one?
Dark Iron Dwarves.
The Dark Iron Dwarves. Now, keep in mind, too, that these six races that are being added initially, these are the ones that are coming with patch 8.0. The implication here seems to be that they are going to add more allied races as the expansion goes along. So if you can think of an allied race that should be on that list that's not, the potential is there that, yes, they will show up eventually. Pretty fascinating, honestly.
Yeah. Ian didn't say if they were going to do it this expansion or not, but he definitely said this was something they were going to do, that they were going to have more allied races. He very deliberately never said, didn't say, in this expansion, like, but he did say it.
Well, and that goes back to some of the art panels too that they were talking about later on, where a lot of this, and as players, we have to understand that while we've been begging for these for years, Wildhammer, that it takes time, it takes effort, it takes rigging too, because it's not just skin swaps at this point anymore. It's not just swapping some polygons. Everything goes deeper, because now you have to worry about the interaction between all the armor sets and those new skins that you just created. A great example of this is during one of the panels, I talked about hats, because there's a ton of, you know, Kul'Tiras hats in the world. And one of the questions was, is it going to, you know, be compatible with every hairstyle? And the answer is, well, we'd like to, but it's a lot harder than you think. And that's just a hat with hairstyle.
Yeah.
So now you start going with armor, with new body types and new skins and everything else, it becomes more complicated. So I really like the idea that they made a commitment to saying that we'd like to do more with this later on. And the fact that we're getting six fully rigged, fully animated, fully interactable, you know, races at 8.0 launch is huge.
They did, however, cheat a little. Let's not get crazy.
They did use
elves and tauren and trolls and dwarves and draenei. So these are all, they're close. It wasn't as much work as.
Well, I mean, and this is where I would say, if you haven't listened to our conversation with Jesse on the last one, we talk about this a little bit too, where even some of those that have been there, yes, they're in the game, but they have certain interactions. Like Nightborn can't wear armor currently.
No, I'm not talking about that. I know all that. I'm just saying it's smart of them to not
start
try
with
and
these
throw
ones. Right,
don't yeah. throw in Saberon right away, for God's sake. You know, at least go with an elf.
I think what I appreciate about this, the whole allied races thing, it has nothing to do with the gameplay part. Because, I mean, yes, the gameplay part is cool and everything, but this is the lore show. What I appreciate is that they're giving us lore. Like, they're giving these people reasons to join, and we have to actually, like, go out there and it's not just an automagic, oh, hey, new expansion. By the way, these guys have decided to sign up. No, we need to go make them. We need to go convince them that this is a worthwhile thing to do. And I really appreciate that. And I appreciate that in terms of, oh, this is more endgame story that we'll get, because this is all stuff that's going to come once we hit 120. So I'm kind of excited about it, honestly, in a way. Going back to Eleftheros' question here, though, whether or not the capital cities befall before or after the allied races join the Alliance and the Horde. Obviously, we've kind of determined that it's going to be after. This is, you know, the capital cities are going to do their thing, and then after that, at some point in the nebulous future, we will convince these guys to join. But does that make a difference for you guys, that we're doing this after this disastrous event thing instead of before the disastrous event?
I think it makes more sense to do it after, because story-wise, if you think about it, it's after a catastrophe that you try to find more people to help you with what you're dealing with, right? You try to find allies to help you. And so with the capital cities burning, or the strongholds being under assault or having fallen, whatever the case is, it makes sense to reach out, like, okay, well, we just got our butts handed to us. We need help. Who do we know we can call on? Hey, remember that time we helped you with that magical addiction? It's time to call in a favor. Like, it makes more sense story-wise, as opposed to beforehand trying to solidify these things. Because if the story is progressing the way we think it is, at the end of Legion, we're still fighting as one unified front. It's still Horde and Alliance working together towards one end. And then you look at certain leaders that are in place, like Anduin, who he's, for all of you saying he's a wimp, he's not. But yes, he values peace.
Can
he
we talk for a minute? Can we just mention for a minute exactly how badass Anduin came off in that trailer? I mean,
people were like making cracks and I was making them too. So I went back and watched the trailer. I watched it frame by frame. In that trailer, Anduin takes out two orcs in two shots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, like that's the first thing you see him do. He takes out two orcs in two shots with a sword, mind you. He isn't like magic zapping them. He uses his father's sword and just boom, boom, takes two of them out, gets hit by Sorfang and gets up. Like he doesn't stay down. He gets up from being hit by Sorfang. Also, again, Greymane beats Sorfang, by the way, and I need that to be mentioned. Gen is stronger than Sorfang. It's canon now. Anyway.
Sorfang gets up. Okay, continue. Yeah,
he gets up after he gets hit. Anyway, but after Anduin does all that, we see the chaos of war. We see that, you know, Sylvanas has done an amazingly cool thing and blown up a siege tower and rallied the Horde. And Anduin's response to this is to basically heal the entire Alliance army.
He pulls a Mercy. He pulls a pre-nerf Mercy. He does a mass res on the whole dang army.
Well, I mean, it was canon and WoW before Mercy.
I
but yes.
know, but still.
It's
I
actually
mean,
a lot
the whole
cooler
glowing
than,
bubble
it, it
and the
sword. It is a lot cooler
the...
than just a mass res, though, because it's not just a mass res. He's also, it is this one thing that I will give them amazing credit for. It is an amalgamation of priesthood abilities in that one scene. You have the giant barrier that like a disciplined priest would raise. You have this ring of healing, this healing nova that goes out, as well as this mass res all simultaneously. Like if that is not like kick butt and chew bubblegum badass, I don't know what to
Anduin,
say.
Anduin, in that moment for me, Anduin, like, fully transcended from that little boy with the generic model back in vanilla that was standing mm-hmm. in the throne room and got escorted out when the big dragon showed up to, like, this is a leader. I mean, well, he's all grown up and saving China.
Well, here's the other thing.
Mulan.
Well, here's the other things that are important about that, too, to the note, that this sequence with him are all callbacks to things that have been happening with Anduin over the years, over the expansion. This is the culmination of his story. First of all, he's on the front line, somewhere he never would have been until recently. Second of all, he's using his sword.
He didn't want to be there, and he's there now.
But he's there now. He's using a sword, the thing his father had him trained in routinely, like getting him ready to defend himself. You see the culmination of that. You see the culmination of the harnessing and the call of the light. Like this is sort of like this big explosive point of his story.
Also, like, I gotta say, Anduin's armor.
Oh
that
God,
helmet,
I want that helmet. I want that helmet so badly.
So wait, top what, notch.
What did they? It's like my dad had a pretty elaborate set of armor. Oh, don't worry, man. We got that topped. How would you like a gold and silver lion suit? I guess I would like that. I never thought about this. It's going to be kind of heavy, isn't it? You're a hero class. It's fine.
It's all good. It's all good, kid. So, okay. Moving on from there, though, let's go ahead and go to the next question. It's a question about NPC age, Jaina/Rathion, these two characters in particular. I kind of want to talk about these two characters anyway, so this is good. Question says, do you consider their age depending on what their date of birth is or how they are written/depicted in-game and media? Because Rathion seems to be used as if he was at least as old as Anduin, while Jaina went from young and naive to old and jaded real fast.
I wouldn't
like
say real
Jaina
fast.
Old.
Yeah.
Not
jaded,
old.
Sure. Old, no.
I wouldn't call her old, but I would say jaded, maybe. I don't know if I'd say jaded, even. I'd say...
Jaded would be, I don't care anymore. I don't care. She very much cares.
Stern resolve, I think. The kind of resolve that we haven't seen. When she showed up, when they showed her in the whole, like, announcement, and she, like, they had that moment where she stepped over and she looked like she was really tired and really kind of angry and just fed up with the world in general. I'm like, yeah, I want to see more of that. I want to see that, Jaina. I need to address her in a Know Your Lore. We'll get there in, like, a couple of weeks here. I will cover Jaina.
To address the question specifically, though, like
yeah, let's address that specifically.
I'm more about how they're written in the moment than what their actual date of birth is, because you can write a character and have experiences that shape who you are more than your age. And this is true of real life as well and every other written media. So having them be more reactionary to the lives that they have led and the events that have unfolded upon them feels more realistic to me, feels more immersive to me in the story of the character and the lore that surrounds them versus, oh yeah, you're actually only 30 years old. Why are you acting like an 80-year-old person?
Well, for one thing, yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The whole thing with Jaina is if you sat down and listed the events of Jaina's life in chronological order.
It's no wonder she is where she is.
Oh, yeah.
It's like she was born 3 years before the First War. So she's younger than Anduin or Arthas. In that time, she has been apprenticed to the.
She's not younger than Anduin.
Not Anduin, sorry, Varian.
Varian, yeah.
Yeah. She's younger than Varian or Arthas. But she's obviously much older than Anduin. But in that time, she has been apprenticed to Antonidas. She's been hit on by the Prince of the Night of the Blood Elves when he wasn't a Blood Elf yet. She's basically led an exodus away from the Eastern Kingdoms to Kalimdor, watched her father die rather than help him because she was trying to broker peace and he wouldn't hear it. Led Theramor, watched her ex-fiance die after having helped oppose him throughout. It's just, she was there for the Third War. She's been there through all this. She's watched Varian die now. There's just so much. I'm not even like, I didn't even get Aegwynn in here. She had one of the Guardians of Tirisfal as her chamberlain. Like, and then her city got blown up. I mean, it's just like, I'm sitting here trying to put it all out and I can't. It just bottles up.
She's been through too much.
It's a lot. It's a lot for any one person to handle. And
Jaina's... calling her young and naive, I think, is disingenuous to the character, too.
She was never really naive. Never. No.
No,
she was young and hopeful.
Young,
but
sure, yes. Yeah. But that was years ago.
I think as far as Jaina is concerned, like I said, I want to write a know your lore about her because her story in particular has been a very lengthy one. And I'm glad that we're seeing her come back, and I'm glad that we're going to see some kind of resolution to her story. Moving on, though, Rathian. The reason Rathian acts the way he does... Yeah, he's a dragon. That's the way he acts. We don't know how dragons age. We don't really know much about their lifespan. We don't know how they work or operate. I mean, he's like, what, 4 now, I think? Probably in the timeline, 4 or 5. But he acts like he's Anduin's age because that's apparently where dragons are at. They're very smart creatures, I guess.
When I was playing vanilla, there was a little blue dragon in UBRS.
Yes.
Who basically sparked a mission. He was sent to UBRS as an agent, as a whelp.
Yep.
They send their whelps
Obby.
Out. Obby. The whelps do things. They're not, like, dragon whelps are not like, okay, we're going to coddle and protect you.
Infants, right?
Yeah. They can think and act. They're still,
We learned from Rathian, anyway, that, I mean, he detected things that were going on outside while he was still in his egg. So
we still don't know a whole lot about dragons is what it boils down to. Like we know some things. We know what they've told us.
I forgot about Obby though, Rossi. I really did.
I didn't remember him either until we were talking about this, and I'm like, wait a minute, what about that dragon?
Even as recently as Legion, though, there's a quest over in where the Withered are, where you're sent with a guide, and that guide happens to be a blue dragon flight whelp. Like,
Azuna.
And Zuna, like, that whelp is showing you what to do, like, and it's talking to you. It's or the quest where you have to destroy the pylons. You're summoning whelps to do that. You're not summoning full-grown dragons. And those whelps, well, they know how to consume magic. They know how to do things. So, like, while, yes, we are, we have several missions where we're trying to protect the whelps, and we've had that sort of established, we have more establishing that they are just, once they're born, they are full active members of their flight, and they are expected to perform duties like any other member. Those duties may be specific to what their capabilities are, but we don't know what their capabilities are. We sure as heck have proof that they're more powerful than we think they are.
I want to take a minute here to point something out that came up last night. Obviously, I wasn't at BlizzCon this year, so I didn't get any hands-on with anything. However, something came up from people that had played through the different experiences that were there. Apparently, And we're going to take this with a gigantic grain of salt because we all remember what High Mountain was in beta. But apparently, in these demos, Rathian was in Stormwind. He didn't say anything. He had no dialogue. He was just in Stormwind with the collective group of Alliance people. He was not in Orgrimmar. So I don't know if this is a sign that maybe he has chosen his side. I mean, he chose a side kind of pretty much back in Mists of Pandaria and then threw up his hands in frustration when we didn't follow through. But,
Anne, yes. Do you know what you just did?
What?
You just caused Archive of Our Own to crash as literally millions of people tried to log on and begin writing their Anduin fanfics. So, thanks.
It's all about the Randwin. No, so... We don't really...
Did you just make a name up for it?
The name has been there, Rossi. Where have you been?
It has been
Randwin for a long time. Yes, Randwin.
Anduthon or something. Okay,
do not Google that, folks. Just do not Google that. Anyway, well, you might end up with some adorable artwork, but do not Google that. Anyway, so, yeah, apparently that happened in, like I said, the demo stations that they had on the show floor there at BlizzCon. Whether or not that's actually going to develop into anything, or whether he was just a placeholder that was placed there, or whether they did mean to put him in Orgrimmar, like they were going to put him in both cities, but they hadn't plopped him down in Orgrimmar yet, or whether he's just there temporarily and they're going to remove him, as they did with High Mountain last expansion. We don't know. But he had a presence, very briefly, and I was very happy to hear about it, because he deserves to be in the story here somewhere.
Story-wise, it would make a potential amount of sense for him to sort of, I don't want to say split the flight, but if the High Mountain Tauren are going to the Horde, we already have a uncorrupted black dragon that has aligned itself with the High Mountain, so we kind of already have a black dragon over there. I could totally see Rathian sort of going to the Alliance to maintain balance.
Or maybe Rathian's like secretly working with Ebonhorn, because Ebonhorn did say that he was going to go catch up with the family or whatever.
Yeah.
So maybe Rathian was like, okay, you go handle the Horde side of things. I got the Alliance side covered and we'll meet up later and figure things out. And Ebonhorn was like, yes, sounds like a plan. Okay. Because they are, after all, black dragons.
Yep.
I don't know. See, look at that. We're already building things that don't exist. So let's go ahead and move on to the next question here. Next question is from Zayr Pally, who says, I'm not very excited for this big departure lore-wise from where we've been in Legion, in parentheses here. Class orders, halls appear to be gone. No more working together for the greater good. Legion races choosing sides, etc. From a lore perspective, can you see any way to justify this turn of events? For example, Sylvanas sees some advantage to burning Teldrassil, so the Horde do, and then the Alliance attack Undercity as retribution. Would even the burning of Teldrassil make Anduin turn on the Horde when the death of his father didn't?
First off, they can. It's not that hard to come up with a lore perspective to justify this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even like this development, and I can justify it.
Sure.
The Horde and the Night Elves have been fighting for years. The Night Elves have been losing territory to the Horde throughout the entire history of World of Warcraft. The Horde finally just deciding we're going to burn Teldrassil and drive the Elves out so we can cut down all the trees. That's not hard to imagine.
And I mean, and it's not like Garrosh almost wanted. It's just continuing that agenda almost.
Sylvanas is in a position in, if you read the Before the Storm opening, Sylvanas is in a position in Orgrimmar where she's tentative. She doesn't really have control of them, and she even feels like she's losing control back home. So if that's how it went down, I could see her doing it for a variety of reasons. But in terms of what Anduin wanted peace, but the death of his father didn't make him turn on the Horde because there were burning Legion guys literally raining from the sky.
We don't know what he knows about his father's death, right? Like,
yeah,
but we don't know how much insight the light has given him.
Even when Jaina was saying straight up, you know, we have to attack the Horde. Anduin's objection wasn't the Horde are my friends. It was Jaina. This isn't the time. Like, think about this. We have
there are bigger things to worry about here.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not saying Anduin wants a war with the Horde. You know, that's not what I'm saying. I don't know what his thoughts are yet. I haven't gotten to read the book yet. And I will as soon as it comes out, but that's not out yet. So, but the entirety of the interaction in Legion wasn't one of Anduin the Peacemaker. It was Anduin the shell-shocked young man who found himself thrust into a position he didn't even want, younger than he expected to have it, and with a world-shaking catastrophe falling upon his shoulders at the same time. Anduin was trying to find his feet. And as Velen said, when he finds his feet, he'll be a great king. And Gen's response was, he needs to find it now. You know, that's what this is. To a degree, you know, you've got Gen right there saying, you know, let's attack the Horde. Let's attack Undercity. I don't see, once the war's over, if the Horde actually did something like burn Tel Drassel, yeah, I don't see Anduin hesitating.
Well, he'd have to. He would have to, because they're members of the alliance that he's, you know, sworn to protect. That these are
that
essentially,
kind of action,
in effect, his people.
Yeah, that kind of action requires a really decisive response, an immediate decisive response.
Mention his closest advisor is Jen Greymane, who, let's be honest, they sacked Tel Drassel, where his people sought, you know, refuge. Yeah, I can guarantee you we go to Anduin. We need to react. This is what happened. My people were in that place. We need to counterattack. I could totally see that happening, because it would make sense for the character that has the most close counsel to Anduin of any of the others.
I need to go back and I need to watch that trailer again, because it struck me in the moment the first time I watched it, and I didn't go back and watch the whole thing again, because I had a million other things that I was doing this weekend. But as I was watching it, and I was watching Anduin in particular and what he was doing out there on the battlefield, that moment where he's like sitting there and then the sword that he's holding, his father's sword, starts to glow with that light.
Charlemagne, yeah.
Yeah, my whole thought on that, and as I'm like reading his face here, and I don't know if the cinematics team, I don't know what they go for when they go. They go as far as they can to kick us in the guts and make us cry. Like, that's what they do. I'm pretty sure. And I'm pretty sure that half the cinematic team would back me up on that. They like the taste of our tears. But as I was watching it, I was just struck by this. I don't know. It's like, this is the one place and the one situation that Anduin never wanted to be in. And he was very much like Jaina, in that he was kind of that proponent for peace. And he spent all that time telling his father, look, maybe there's a better way. Maybe we can get along with these guys. I mean, even when he was a little kid, like the whole thing in the comics where they went to that whole diplomacy summit, the diplomatic summit, and Thrall was there and Garrosh was there. It was Anduin who convinced his dad that, you know, maybe this is a good idea. Maybe you should listen to Aunt Jaina. Maybe, you know, everybody's got like the potential for this kind of thing.
This is the guy that basically, when Garrosh Hellscream crushed every bone in his body, still managed to find a way to reach across and say, hey, this doesn't have to go down like this.
In war crimes, yeah. In war crimes, he went and he spoke to Garrosh and like had conversations with him. So in that moment, in the trailer there, it was like Anduin was, to me, it looked like he was almost having that kind of inner struggle of, okay, I have to choose. It's one or the other. And maybe I need to leave the one thing that I've been following. Maybe it's time to leave that behind. And it was almost like that, like the sword was glowing in response to that. And to me, and again, I was probably just reading this because, like I said, it was just in the moment and I was all caught up in the moment. But it was like, it was almost like his dad was there telling him, look, it's going to be okay. And that's when he stood up and started kicking butt. And did the whole light show thing and all of that. And I was just like, aw, I'm so proud of you.
We haven't really, I mean, the problem is that so much is going on and we only have an hour to talk about it.
Yeah.
But one of the things that, watching that cinematic and watching, you know, finding out the stuff in the panels, the thought that keeps running through my head is that in a lot of players are in the same position as Anduin, where they didn't really want this. And they don't get the faction conflict. It's not their thing. But the Horde isn't going to let it go, ever. They're never going to stop. And you can really feel for him that, you know, yeah, he would like peace. He'd like there to be peace between the Alliance and the Horde. But the Horde sees that as weakness. They always say, like, the Sylvanas' lines, we've forgotten what makes us strong. And what makes the Horde strong is taking from other people. That's what you see in this cinematic. That's what's going on. When they get their second wind, when she jumps down and blows up the tower, And, you know, Anduin would love to be the king who ruled with peace like his grandfather did for a long time. But he's never going to be that. The Rin kings don't get that. His grandfather didn't get to live that way. Lane died fighting the Horde.
Oh, God, and now I'm remembering that whole short story between him and Varian.
Yeah. And Varian, like, there was a really... I think there's a kind of touching symmetry here in that in Battle for, like, you know, in the Siege of Orgrimmar, when Anduin was like, Father, what are you doing? And he goes, what a king must do. And he tried to make peace. He actually reached out to them and said, you know, all right, this, we're going to leave. This doesn't have to be worse than it is. And now Anduin is, he's at the place where that, this is where you ended up from trying to do that. It was good that you tried to do that.
Do you remember what Varian said after that?
Yeah, we will. If this fails, we will destroy you.
If this ever happens again, we will end you, or something along those lines.
Yeah, we will end you.
Well, Varian's not here to do it, but his kid sure seems to be stepping up to the plate. Ooh,
his kid, who he tutored and parted his wisdom upon. Yeah, not terribly surprising.
But it is in a way. You called it bittersweet before, and there's a pain when you hit that point in your life where you realize that, you know, you still have your ideals. They still matter to you. They're still meaningful. But sometimes you have to choose between what you'd like and the best you can do. And he'd love to be the peacemaker, but he has to be the king first. He has to protect
his people. He has to protect people, yeah.
And it's what you see. What's interesting is the approach of the two main characters in the cinematic. Sylvanas inspires through violent, effective action. She appeals to their rage. You know, she shoots that tower and screams for the Horde and gets them up and moving, and they're angry and they're charging out. And she is defending her city, of course, at this moment. That's not to be ignored. But Anduin doesn't inspire. He goes and does violent things. Like, he turns a troll into paste. There's a troll who hits again with lightning. Anduin pulverizes that guy. If you watch the fight between him and the troll, he just pulverizes him. There's a scene where he pulls Charlemagne up, and when it comes down, there's an explosion, and that troll is broken. So Anduin does violent action, but that's not how he inspires people. He inspires people by putting the sword down and putting the shield up. And all those soldiers get up and pick up their swords and spears and stand as one. And he doesn't even say that?
Yeah, he says stand together.
Like I said, there's a lot of character beats that I think we're going to have come back in this expansion that we've seen in the past that we're going to have codas and refrains to. One of them is the fact that Sylvanas is apparently going full Banshee.
Which made me very happy. And I mean,
that move that she did in the trailer where she just like vanished and then poof and then scream for the whole. Oh, goosebumps. Dang.
I appreciate the fact that there's some cross-pollinization between game franchises here, because a lot of the stuff she was doing is also some of her moves from Heroes of the Storm. But
yeah, but in terms
it
of
showcases her power.
Thing, but not just that. Did you see the look on Sorfang's face when she did it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sorfang was like, I don't know what just happened, but okay. And the fact that they finally put Sorfang in a trailer.
Yes.
I was very happy about that. Very happy
about
that. Well,
he's the default de facto leader of the orcs. He better be in that trailer.
Okay.
That poor guy.
So let's... we're running out of time. I'm so sad. Okay. I think we have time for one more question here. So I want to take this one because this is also something that a lot of people have been talking about. Obviously, the allied races are assigned with a particular faction. This kind of addresses that. This one's from Kaz, who says, looking at the allied races, I wish they were all bifactional, but I can construct some justification for most. Tauren, Draenei, trolls, and dwarves, each aligning with the others of their race. And Alaria has always been alliance, so I get the Void Elves. It's the Nightborn that I'm most confused about. Why the Horde from a lore perspective? I know it's for a balance from a systems perspective, but it still needs some justification, doesn't it? As far as like the story is concerned. What do you guys think?
Justification for it. No, there is justification for it.
Sure.
As much as I don't buy, there's a lot of people arguing, well, Taronda was mean to them. I don't buy that. But the fact is that the Night Elves have zero sympathy for a bunch of magic addicts who once blew the planet up and then hid for 10,000 years and almost blew it up again. You know?
Think of it from a societal standpoint. Like, Night Elves just recently started having mages again, like within the last few years, because they didn't like them. They thought that would cause destruction and death. And look at everything that magic has caused us over these 10,000 years. Yeah, I could totally see them not feeling welcome there.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, there's also the fact that with the Blood Elves are like, yeah, we were the Highborn too. Like, the Nightborn were the Highborn. Mm-hmm. The Blood Elves are like, you know, hey, we're your distant cousins. Whereas the Night Elves are like, yes, we recovered from the disease you spread among our people. I mean, yes, the Night Elves look more like the Nightborn, but the Blood Elves act.
And from a larger perspective here, though, I think you need to kind of take a step back and look at the Nightborn as a whole. It's not just the relationship that they have with the Night Elves as opposed to the Blood Elves. You're also looking at these guys were encapsulated for 10,000 years, and they developed their own society and their own system. And in a way, they're kind of like that snapshot of old, old, old world highborn society. They're the last remnant of it. It's just them. And back during the War of the Ancients, it was made very clear with the end of that war that the highborn were not welcome, period. And the Night Elves took in the remnants of highborn society, who decided they couldn't get away from playing with magic. And in response, the Night Elves kicked them out and said, okay, no, you need to leave. Like, they wanted nothing to do with them. So here we have this society that has been removed from everything else, like encapsulated in a bubble for 10,000 years. They have no idea what's going on in the outside world at all. And I guess what you have to look at there is, who is welcoming in that situation? Who's going to welcome the last dregs of a society that almost pretty much died out? The Horde is thematically, and has been thematically since Vanilla, has always been the faction that takes in these outsiders and takes in these people that are isolated, takes in these people that are alone, and gives them a home of sorts, a family of sorts. So thematically, I could see why they would lean more Horde. And it's not just about that whole relationship with the Night Elves, although I think that does play into it. And again, it's not just that, like, Taranda was mean to them. Look, Taranda was perfectly justified in everything that she said, and the Night Elves are perfectly justified in having any kind of reservation about these people, because the Highborn and Azshara sparked a civil war that literally tore the world apart. They don't want to see that again. And well, as much as you think, oh, well, but the Nightborn are the good guys or whatever. No, they aren't, because I don't know if you realize it or not, but that whole battle that we were fighting in Suramar was because, I don't know, half to three quarters of the city decided that allying with the Burning Legion was their best chance for survival. They were willing to do it again. They were willing to do what they had done in the War of the Ancients again. That's what the Caldari saw. That's what Taranda saw. She's not going to want to take them back, because who's to say they're not going to turn around and do something just as horrific down the road, you know?
And to go even beyond that, if you want to look at anything that's not just a breakdown of the society, but you want an example of what's in game currently, and I have a feeling this plays a large part in it too, go to our nice little floating ship in the sky over Argus right now and take a look at who's talking with Oculeth. Take a look who's spending time. Sit there for a couple minutes and listen to the dialogue. It's Leandrin who's sitting there talking with him, spending time away from the front to answer his questions, where the others aren't. They're not paying attention to him. They're not answering his questions.
She's not trying to convince him of anything either way. She's just answering his questions straight up.
Exactly. She's just like, okay, you have these questions. I understand. We were in your position. Let me help you transition into interacting with the world again. Let me help you. And that's the thing. Like, and I got to give them credit for the way they characterized Lady Leandrin recently, is that she's not coming across as like, this is to make an ally later on down the road. This is, you're an elf too. We've gone through similar things. I'm going to help you because I remember how this feels. I remember what this is like. This was awful. You're just coming back from awful. Like, and it's sort of this touching moment where it fits her connection to the light, right? Like, it fits that connection of her being sort of that blood knight. And it characterizes her really, really well. But then you listen to that and it makes perfect sense that Oculeth would go back and say something like
Thagron,
would say, here's everything that I've learned. here's what I've seen, here's my interactions with all of the races. And I'm not saying that, like, you know, Forsaken are nowhere to be seen, obviously. The Torn don't have anything, really. The Orcs don't have anything. The Goblins don't have anything, really, to interact with them. But the Blood Elves did. And I think that makes a big difference in
Rossi,
just my two cents.
Rossi, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I've said, I play a Night Elf, and I went and saved them, and then they basically did this to me, so I'm not happy with them. But that's, you know, everybody plays the character they play, so now the people aren't going to feel the same way. I do think it kind of, having both the High Mountain and the Nightborn go help the Horde after my Alliance character saved both of them is real irritating lore-wise. It is not something I like, but yeah, I don't, it's perfectly justifiable in the game lore. There's no reason. Why wouldn't the High Mountain go join the rest of the Tauren? You know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's nice that you helped us, but they're my people. And as far as the Nightborn weren't going to get much of a welcome from the Alliance. I don't think that was ever going to happen. They were going, because.
Go ahead.
No, I'm good. I'm done.
Okay. I was going to, I think we're going to call it on questions right there because we're kind of over our time here, but we'll go ahead and carry those forward into the next episode. I do have something that I want to bring up to the two of you, though, if you have a little bit of extra time.
Let's go for it.
Okay. So I'm just going to lay out my thoughts here because I haven't found a coherent way to actually phrase this as a question because, again, I'm very tired. We have this whole battle going on between Alliance and Horde, and, you know, the Horde has Kalimdor, Alliance has Eastern Kingdoms, except for those two outliers up north. There's the Exodar, and there's Silvermoon and Quel'Thalas. Here's my question, though. How allied to their factions are these two societies? Because when I think about it, and I keep going back to the end of Burning Crusade, where it wasn't the Horde that came forward and helped the Blood Elves restore the Sunwell. It wasn't the Horde that, like, thought to do that. It was the Draenei. It was Velen that came forward with the Heart of Maru and said, this was all part of a plan. This was part of a prophecy. Let me help you. And puts the Heart of Maru back into the Sunwell and essentially reignites it. And brings the light into what was once just an arcane font. Now it's arcane, and there's also the light in there as well, because again, this is like Naru power, just like, you know, flowing through that thing. So in a way, it feels like the Blood Elves owe the Draenei something over any kind of like faction imbalance or, you know, factional fighting back and forth, whatever. The whole reason the Blood Elves went with the Horde was because the Horde would take them in. Sylvanas showed up. Sylvanas showed up and said, hi, remember me? I was dead, but now I'm back. And would you like to join the Horde? I can help facilitate that, and we'll get you some allies, because obviously, you know, the Alliance has done nothing for you. They tried to, you know, lock you up. They took your prince. They did all this other stuff. So, you know, why not come join with our side? And we saw that reflected a little bit, though, in Mr. Pandaria later, because Lorthamar Theron, for a while there, for like a hot minute there, he was thinking about dropping the Horde entirely and reforging that connection with the Alliance. And obviously what went down there and, you know, Jaina's retaliation for everything that went down there, her justifiable retaliation for everything that went down there, she kicked the Blood Elves out of Dalaran. She had this whole purge thing go on. And Lorthamar said, you know what? Nope, never mind. We don't need you guys. That's okay. But I'm wondering, these two, like I said, they're kind of like on the northern reaches of both of these continents that are in chaos. And I can't help but think that their individual stories are going to have to come into play at some point, because I can't see these two people going at each other's throats. I mean, even in Warlords, when we went to Old Draenor and we went out to Auchendone, who was there? The Blood Elves showed up. They showed up to help the Draenei because it was kind of like repayment for everything that they'd given them. Were there any other Horde characters in that area? Nope, it was all Blood Elves. So I don't... Is this something that you guys think that we're going to see reflected in Battle for Azeroth? Because it feels like these two outliers, there's got to be something going on here.
I don't know, because we're going to... A lot going on.
that what you're bringing up is actually the basis of a lot of people have been calling for like a neutral faction, which as much as I would love to see a third faction introduced to the game world, which, and I think it makes sense thematically, I don't think it'll ever actually happen. But I have a feeling that what draws them in to the conflict, one of which they would probably both rather stay out of because of where they are geographically located, is that I think the conflict is going to come knocking to their doorstep in some capacity. Because
I'm just wondering how they're going to answer it, because Velen has never really... Velen is not a proponent of petty battles. Velen has the big picture in mind.
But I mean, it's really weird because you've also got the Lightforged involved.
Right. So how is that story going to play out?
Well, you have the Lightforged and the Void Elves on the same side. Like,
yeah, that's in of itself kind of weird. There's something that really... We don't have time for a really long answer here. So I'll just say that getting to see how the Void Elves and Lightforged join the Alliance is important because it kind of informs as to what's going on here.
Like, I agree.
There's something strange about the idea of those two groups standing side by side in the Alliance. And are the Lightforged there because of Turalyon? Because that, I feel, almost feels like it would be there because of Turalyon more than because of Velen.
Probably.
You know what I mean?
Because, I mean, with what we know Velen's happens to them, he's the default leader.
Yeah, right? Velen's been gone for however long. Turalyon, however, has been fighting with the Army of the Light for like 1,000 years or whatever.
Yeah, so there's... I don't know. I need to see it before I can really... I'm trying, like... You were there for the BlizzCon show where I was pretty salty. I've been trying since then to not be, to give the story time to happen and to let it... let myself see it before I judge. But I gotta tell you, if Blizzard's goal was to make me, the player, hate the Horde as much as my Alliance characters, they have succeeded. They've actually, in a way, it's amazing. They have found a way to finally get me involved in this faction conflict. I want the Horde burned to the ground. And in a way, that's really impressive. Because I was Anduin. That's why I said, you feel for Anduin, because I was Anduin. I was the guy who actually wanted faction peace. And like Jaina and Anduin before me, now I'm not. So I feel like this is actually what they're doing in this expansion. So in a way, it's really successful.
And I think too that our big, I think the big reveal or the big thought on those is, like Rousey said, I think it's going to be down to the story of those allied races. And I think those are going to be sort of the defining story beats that dictate the justification, I guess, for how everything plays out. Because I think that the current races are going to play, they're not going to be completely free of the interactions and what happens with bringing those allied races in.
And I think that, you know, the other thing that's kind of spurring this curiosity in my mind regarding the Draenei and the Blood Elves in particular is that there was kind of conflicting reports. Like I said, we asked if the Blood Elves and the Draenei were going to be involved in the expansion, and we were told no, but somebody else said, oh, they might be. So it's kind of like a back and forth here. We don't know what it is. However, that's going to wrap us up for the show. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch, and your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And for the listeners of Blizzard Watch, Audible's offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. They have plenty of Blizzard's audiobooks available for that free 30-day download. If you'd like to check that out, go to blizzardwatch.com/audible and give the free trial a go. If you have any questions for the next episode of Lore Watch, please feel free to email us at podcast@blizzardwatch.com and put Lore Watch in the subject line so that we know that it's intended for this show. Thanks so much, you guys, for listening, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.